Welcome to It's All Journalism. My name is Michael O'Connell. I'm here with fellow producer Julie O'Donohue. We've got two guests today. Matt Razak worked with Julie and I at the Connection newspapers in Northern Virginia. He was an entertainment reporter there, and he's gone on to be a movie reviewer, game reviewer. Who's it you work for now?
I write for a site called Flixis for movies and Destructoid for video games.
Aren't you a founder of Flixis?
I am. Okay. Started it off.
Okay. Yes. And also sitting in the room with us today is Jason Fraley, who is W2P's movie reviewer. W2P is the sister station of the station I work for, WFED, here in D.C. And introduce yourself, sir.
Yeah, thanks for having me. Jason Fraley. I've been working here at TOP, which is upstairs in the same building.
Yes.
For about almost five years now. I write our morning show during most of the week, and then Friday mornings I'm on air as our movie critic. It's a blast. Okay. Thanks for having me.
Well, good. I'm hoping this is going to be a fun podcast, because we're going to be talking about something I think a lot of people sort of dream and kind of think would be an ideal job, which is being a movie reviewer. Well, let me ask you that as the first question. Is that an ideal job?
it's a dual-edged sword, I guess. It's a lot of fun because you're doing what you love for a living, and I can't imagine living without movies. So if that part of it's great, I guess the dark side of it for people who think it's glamorous sitting at home in their basement wanting to do it, it can be late nights. You go out to screenings, and at least for me, I have to get up and then write the morning show in the morning. But I think the positives far outweigh the negatives. It's an exciting gig. You're almost the gatekeeper of the movies that come out. And that part of it's thrilling to me.
I think what most people don't realize is that the majority of film critics, the people I see every week at screenings and stuff, it's not their full-time gig. And
right.
So, to be a film critic, it's a full-time job. You have a full-time job in the day, and then you're also spending another 3 hours at every night, not every night, three nights a week or so, depending on how many movies you're reviewing, taking up time there too. So it can be really time consuming, especially, a lot of people say, oh, all they do is watching movies. And most film critics are not just watching movies. They have another job or they're doing something else as well.
Yeah, it's definitely it has to be that labor of love,
right,
passion thing on the side. I mean, I'm sure it's only the upper echelon people, who've been doing it a while with some brand name recognition really get to do it full time. So it's got to be something. If anyone out there wants to do it, make sure you have something else lined up full time, beat it your craft. You have to do it on the side for a while.
So what about the person who, has got their blog? What differentiates you, or how do you differentiate yourself from somebody who just has a blog, who's just, writes up something about every movie they see?
Oh, I actually talked about this with a mentor when I was getting my master's in film over at AU a few years ago. I was talking with Destin Thompson. He used to write for the Washington Post, except I think his byline back then was Destin Howe. And we talked extensively about this because he had gone and talked to Destin. If you're listening, thanks for all the pointers. But he was going on about how it was kind of a sea change in the film critic community, where a bunch of people at the Washington Post who had taken buyouts, they'd been doing it for years and years and years.
Mm-hmm.
And we just talked back and forth about this, this cacophony of internet bloggers now, where when everyone and their mother wants to go start a website and do some reviews. And Destin and I were just kind of talking about how the negative part of that is you get a lot of people that aren't actually academically trained in it, or maybe don't even know their movie history. I mean, I'm sure we all in this room do. But, it could just be someone who knows the last 10 years or the movies of their lifetime. And I think it's important to know what all has come before. And, that way when you're sitting in a theater, more of a spring chicken reviewer would see something on the screen and say, oh, that was great. It's such an original concept. But if you really know your history and where things all come from, you might say, oh, that's been done a million times. So I think that affects how everything's been done. Or if you've just seen all the great movies. I mean, to me, I think only a handful to a dozen truly great movies come out every year. So a lot of it's working through the slog of mediocrity week to week. So to me, I actually really enjoy looking at the bigger picture of the last 100 years and seeing, you take that handful of great movies every year, but then you add, 2008, 2007, 1946, 1947. You know, you have a huge swath of great movies to look at. So I just think that I guess what you try to differentiate yourself is to know your history and know the art and the craft of it, rather than just going on a whim and a prayer. Years of movies.
Is that sort of your perspective?
Yeah, I definitely think it's the history, especially founding a blog, right, where I've brought in writers from everywhere. I know what we looked for was someone who, in our writers, was someone who knew old movies. I mean, our target were a blog, so we're 18 to 35 men. So the majority of our stuff is explosions and breasts.
Right,
but
right.
The what we wanted in a background there so we could have interesting features along with that is someone who knows film history, who when we asked their favorite films didn't just list something in the past 10 years, mm-hmm. but had things, you know, from the golden age
explosions
of film.
Explosions and breasts from the 1940s.
Yes, exactly. Right. We want things like that. So that's really important. And a lot of what when I'm working with new writers and stuff is I say you need to go sit down and you need to watch some of these classics. When we first launched, we put together a list of movies, not the top 10, Flix's top 10 movies, but a list of movies you needed to watch in order to understand the site. And half of them were pre-1960 or so. So yeah, it's real. The difference between someone just hopping on and saying, I love this, is someone who will watch the classics, crap, yeah. You know, the mediocrity as well. One of the things that I love to say is that people always say critics are so harsh. Why are you always coming down on these romantic comedies and stuff? It's like, because we see that romantic comedy every week. Mm-hmm. You see that one romantic comedy every 3 months. We see it every other week. Yeah. So,
well, that was a fun date night out.
Right.
But,
yeah.
Exactly.
You've seen the Philadelphia Story, so you can think back.
Right. Exactly.
It happened one night. I mean, all these, it gets recycled so much.
Over
and when you
and
see it done the first time and even better, and then you see it, you know, recycled again, that's why, whereas someone else might say, oh, that was a really cool movie.
An interesting thing about film critics as opposed to other culture critics is that they tend to review like the gamut, like stuff that is really schlocky and stuff that's like masterpieces. Like, I don't know, like, you know, if you're a book reviewer, you're not reviewing like romance novel and also The Marriage Plot. I mean, that's just like, that's not the way certain other types of, or music reviewers, I don't think necessarily are reviewing like whatever. You know, I don't know, whatever Justin Bieber's doing, and also whatever their specialty is.
The classical guy isn't doing hip-hop as well.
Yeah, I mean, can you talk a little bit about that? Because I feel like people who review film do really see, like, everything.
The gamut. But, you know, just sort of to add on to that, that Roger Ebert, you know, sort of reveled in the fact that he was into low art and high art at the same time.
Oh, I mean, it's... At least personally, it's kind of like my life's movie critic mission is to balance the, you know, the highbrow and the lowbrow. I mean, I actually, before I started here at TOP, similar to you, I founded my own blog. It was called The Film Spectrum, and the whole idea was that movies work on a spectrum of art on one side and entertainment on the other side. And I think you can have great movies on, you know, both sides. I mean, entertainment, you know, Raiders of the Lost Ark, Back to the Future, I mean, these are great movies, and they're just thrilling entertainments. Mm-hmm. On the art side, you know, 8.5, Citizen Kane, all these great movies too. And for me, the reason I love, you know, like a Hitchcock is I think he mastered both. I mean, he's known as the master of suspense for a reason. He was a showman, come on TV, good evening, and all that. But he would make these really thrilling suspense movies on the surface, but then you go back and watch them 20, 30 times later in an academic setting and a film class. I just showed a bunch of high schoolers over to AU in a class I'm teaching, Vertigo. We broke it down. It really cooked their noodle how much is actually going on under the surface on the art side of it. So people like that, are the truly great ones, or John Ford or whoever, who can master, I think, both. It gets back to what you're talking about with the gamut. You have to kind of keep both in mind when you go to review a movie, and it can be kind of tough because you don't want to go in there and you know, watch Iron Man 3 and be like, oh, it didn't have this mise-en-scène that Orson Welles had. And, you know, you don't want to get too, you know, highbrow on it. So you almost have to kind of flip a switch in your mind and say, okay, what is this the art or the entertainment right here? And how does it relate to average people going to the movies?
And the other thing is the filmmakers themselves, the directors, the auteurs, they study film. Yeah. They watch the gamut. I mean, the easy example to give is Quentin Tarantino,
right.
who immersed himself in all of this trash cinema, and he found all the gems, and now he's stringing them together to make movies. I mean, in order for you to sort of almost speak that language, you need to go in and research and see all these films to see what the director is, what influences are playing into him
right.
and or her, and then are coming up on the screen.
I think it is changing a bit, though, with the web, because before... In a print world, you had a film critic at a newspaper, and he did all the movies. But now you have sites devoted to horror film, sites devoted to drama, sites devoted to art film.
Right.
I know a lot of our writers – I mean, I review a ton of our movies, but I know a lot of our writers for Flixus don't feel comfortable reviewing certain types of movies. You know, we've got a guy who loves Korean film, and I wouldn't review a Korean film now because I read his review and I'm like, I knew half of what you just said. You are clearly an expert in this. So the web has really allowed a sort of branching out for film criticism.
That's interesting.
In many ways.
And I actually remain, you know, there's a lot of talk, oh, society's getting, you know, dumbed down and no one's watching the classics.
Society was pretty stupid.
Right, right. But I have a lot of actually hope in this new, you know, the new millennium of, I guess, movie watchers and movie critics. Yeah, you get the, what we're saying, the cacophony of internet bloggers who, you know, writing from their basement or whatever. But I'm hopeful because... the notion of time is almost being erased from the process. And what I mean is you can watch with Netflix or DVR on demand. You can go back and watch any movie ever made like with the click of a button. And there's DVD special features. You can sit there and hear the filmmakers actually giving the audio commentary over top of the movie. You know that these are advantages that didn't exist back then, and also we're kind of living in a right around the millennium came this huge explosion of this the listology craze, I call it, where everyone would look back on the millennium, the 20th century, and do their best lists. And it's now
BFI's top 100.
Taped them all on VHS. They were great every year. They do one a year on CBS. And you literally hear all, you know, Spielberg, Scorsese, like talking about what makes all these movies great, and they count down through them. So I think just that people growing up now, and this is how I did it. You print off a bunch of best lists from all the different publications, and you can go through with a highlighter. And this sounds like this is what you do for your people that want to write. You say, these are the movies you must see. So I think there's exciting opportunities for everyone to go back and rediscover everything.
Mm-hmm.
You know, it's what is it? Was it William Faulkner? You know, the past isn't even past. The past is never dead. In fact, it's not even past. So I think... I think it's an exciting time for it. If you really, you know, bear down and try to learn all the greats.
You say Scorsese. He's done a couple of documentaries where he talks about his influences that are really kind of fascinating. Just from a personal perspective of, you know, the disparate movies that sort of built his story and you know, seeing that and knowing that other directors have gone through the same sort of journey, that they're, you know, he mentioned schlocky movies and westerns and things that he saw as a child that have influences on the films that he does. So, you know, just understanding the history of film and entertainment, I think is really kind of important. Let's because I think we're all kind of like anxious to go into the second half of our discussion here. We're going to talk about the press and Hollywood and how Hollywood, either through television or through movies, is kind of portrayed journalism. And we're going to talk about some of, you know, some of the best and the worst presentations, some of the best and worst movies and TV shows that talk about, that either have, you know, protagonists or have somehow themed about media. I put out on our various social media platforms just the question, you know, tell us what your favorite media-related movie or a TV show is, and I got a ton of responses. However you measure a ton in media or on social media, you know, a lot of the ones are similar. You know, Allison Berto on Facebook said News Radio, the Phil Hartman years, as a TV show. I've got other people who you know, think obvious ones like All the President's Men, mm-hmm. Network, Citizen Kane. I'd forgotten that Citizen Kane. I mean, obviously he was a baron of media, but he was also this. The story itself is told by a newsman going to cover a story, so you actually get to see the news process. So let me ask each of you, Matt, do you have any favorites or ones that come to mind? That
my absolute favorite journalism movie is His Girl Friday.
Yes, I was going to say the same thing. It's a great movie.
It is so good. It's one of the greatest screenplays ever written. And it is, while the idea of journalism in it is still like quick talking, you know, get to the phone, I got a breaking news story, buddy.
Yeah, hard-boiled too.
Yeah. it's got a... strong female protagonist, mm-hmm. Cary Grant, you know, all these great one. And one of the great things about that is it shows how journalism was a field where in a male dominated culture of that time, women could be strong and lead and forward. And the entire premise of it is she's leaving the news. She's this hard nosed right. journalist, mm-hmm. you know, Lois Lane style. Yeah. She's leaving the news to get married and settle down, and Cary Grant spends the entire movie wisecracking and conniving to get her to stay because you know she loves her work more than becoming a housewife.
Yeah,
yeah,
and that was remade as a actually not too bad a movie. Front Page, right? Mm-hmm. From the 70s.
Yeah, well, His Girl Friday was actually, I think, maybe like the second version of, I think it was originally the Front Page before too. And I think it might have even been two male, don't quote me on that. I think it might have been two male characters. And then the Howard Hawks version that we all know and love, I think, put Rosalind Russell in there as a female role.
Yeah. And then, well, and the one in the 70s was oh my God, I can't believe I'm blanking. Jack Lemmon and Walter Matthau. Vehicle, which there were a lot of those after
post
odd
yeah.
couple. They were looking for different ways. One of the other ones that people mentioned, particularly current TV shows, The Newsroom. You know, a lot of people have talked about that. You know, have you guys seen that? What are your thoughts on that? Well, why do you say ugh?
Okay, well, a few different reasons. One is that they're actually covering real news stories. This has been talked to death about the show, but they're covering real news stories, but they're 2 years behind. So they always get things right about, like, what should be covered. Like, for example, I forget because I have not seen the show in about a year, but when the oil rig exploded right. in the Gulf, it was overwhelmed by some other news story. And I guess in the context of The Newsroom, the show, they focus on the right issue or
they
something.
They make the right choice.
They make the right choice. I mean, I find that to be Aaron Sorkin at his worst. I like Aaron Sorkin a lot. I like his shows. I actually, in terms of newsrooms, I think they're covered well. I think Sports Night is a great example mm-hmm. of a news show. I know it's about sports, but I really enjoy it. And I've never been at ESPN, but I suspect that some of that is actually the way that goes down. But The Newsroom, man, I mean, it's him at his most, like, self-righteous and... That drives me crazy about it.
I kind of bailed after a few episodes just because I thought it was a little too preachy.
Right.
That, you know, well, if you're going to stand on the mountain and tell me that you're going to be right all the time, then, you know, I'm less interested. It's less engaging for me
right.
as a viewer.
And cable news, they make mistakes. Because they're covering things fast, I'm sure WTOP does too. We need to hold people accountable when they make, you know, I think the Boston bombing, not to go on a tangent. Like, I think some of that, yeah, we need to hold you accountable for getting certain things wrong. But you are going to change things, you know, rather quickly. You can't always get things right. And so that aspect of it really frustrates me. We don't have to go into Aaron Sorkin's issues with ladies. Powerful ladies who act dopey
all the time.
Yeah, that really drives me crazy. I would say, you know, best television show probably ever, in my opinion. Awful, awful portrayal of a newsroom. I mean, The Wire in the fifth season.
Yeah.
That newsroom, we're talking about a newsroom in the middle of the 2000s, of the aughts, that had no internet presence. There's none of it in the show. And that's also sanctimonious. That's David Simon saying, I think certain things should be covered and certain things shouldn't. And the management in the show is for a show that has all sorts of complex characters all over the place, the management of the newsroom in that show, those people are portrayed as being one-dimensional and power-hungry. And I just don't believe the editor of the Baltimore Sun is really in it to give, I don't know, the Tribune Company as much money as possible. They have a lot of pressure on themselves, and it just showed no understanding of the change that the industry was going through.
My takeaway from that in particular, and we had a couple of people who mentioned the fifth season of The Wire as an example of a newsroom, both good and bad. But my takeaway from it was, from the standpoint of the people who were getting laid off, I think there was one scene where they had the copy editors, you know, these guys who'd been at the paper for years and years and years, debating the use of a particular word, and that was like knowledge and the impression that what was happening in journalism at that point. And this is probably David Simon sort of bemoaning the death of the large newsroom, but you know, in a moment of time, showing that this is what's happening, that the great experience that's being lost. Again, there's a problem if they don't mention digital
ever
at all, because I think that's figures into it a lot. But I think he was more addressing the economics of what was going on in journalism at
right.
that moment, where people were their staffs were getting laid off because the ad revenue was drying up.
Well, and then you mentioned the digital. Then there's House of Cards, where Kate Mara's character goes to work for this hip upcoming online pub called Slugline. I'm really enjoying House of Cards. It's almost hard to with these TV shows to judge until we've seen them in their entirety. We're only a season in of each of these, The Newsroom and House of Cards. It kind of portrays Slugline as a bunch of people laying around in an office.
In a
right
coffee.
Right.
Yeah. It's not quite an office because there are no cubicles. There don't seem to be any phones. Right. There's certainly no desks.
Yeah, and I'm curious to see where they take that show from the journalism perspective, because it seems almost at the end of season one they've started to plant the seed of a little All the President's Men stuff going on with we're not
right.
no spoilers, but a big twist at the end of season one will become something that Kate Mara's character and the rest of their journalism folks start to pursue with a deep throat leakers all over the place, you know.
Props to House of Cards for portraying Kate Mara's character as being rather poor. Sometimes
yes.
that's another news
yeah.
problem.
Were,
you know,
a
I know.
Tiny apartment and yeah.
Yeah, the tiny apartment
with the spiders crawling.
Yeah, exactly.
But you know, that's a show that I like the show, and I did see the problems that they had. There's a moment in it where one of the editors makes some grandiose statement, a dismissive statement about web journalism that no real editor today would really say.
The supposed Washington Post editor
right. yeah,
makes this very dismissive
like, yeah.
comment.
Yeah, well, and of course, I think maybe he loses his job in the process or something. But I mean, I don't think we've yet had it's still too early for us, I think, to have a journalism movie or TV show that's kind of reflective of what's going on at the moment right now, I think.
I will say, is the name of the show, the movie State of Play, the one with Russell Crowe
yes.
and
yes.
Rachel McAdams?
Mm-hmm.
Okay, so that had a little of the awful, like, internet versus print
right.
people.
Russell Crowe sitting behind, like, right. these stack of papers,
right.
like, I'm a journalist.
That had a little bit of that.
Yeah.
I mean, what was disappointing about House of Cards is that came out in 2013 and still had that. Okay, State of Play, I thought, though, in some respects, got some things okay. I really enjoyed the movie, and I was not upset by the awful way the journalism was portrayed.
But just to sort of go back, I guess, in a historical context
right.
of how journalism is in film.
Right.
I think, and maybe,
we haven't
I'm
talked
not sure
about
if it's,
Superman.
Well,
oh, yeah.
The greatest hero in the world.
Which was left out of Man of Steel. They totally got rid of
it.
That was my least favorite part. There was not enough Daily Planet.
We will have a
but
2-hour long podcast.
Yeah, that's another
we'll get onto that.
But we did see a reporter follow up a story.
Yeah,
she's a Pulitzer Prize winning reporter.
We saw her go from source to source to source to source to piece together a report.
What a wonderful multicultural newsroom.
What are you saying?
But from a historic, and I'm not sure if this is art reflecting life or life reflecting art, but I feel like journalism now in movies is far more blown open, even if it's realistic or not. But back in the day, there's sort of like this idealistic gumshoe reporter look
right.
at things. And now you've got like Broken Glass, you know, where the story is about journalism doing wrong, or journalists, not journalism, but journalists doing wrong. And it's not, you know, there's still good journalist movies where journalists are the heroes, right. Do something right.
All the Prisons or something like that.
Right. But it's very, it's a much deeper look at journalism in modern film.
And I think the turning point was 1976. It's, you have, which I, to me, it's still the two best journalism movies for print, All the President's Men, and for broadcast, it's Network. Mm. And kind of what you're talking about, I think if we're going to draw an arc in history and do the shift, that's where it is. Because All the President's Men is the idealistic. Yeah. These are the guys going after him. Even the way they shoot it with the lights in the newsroom, it's like, this is the place of enlightenment. Yeah. And it's a fabulous movie.
Yeah.
But then the same year you get Network, which is the... Maybe the first, like, truly, really cynical, look out, this is where we're headed. You have Faye Dunaway, who is this TV producer of the network, who is so involved in it that even there's a scene where she's having sex with William Holden.
Like a man.
Yeah.
That's the joke.
But those attitudes have changed, Lynn, but thankfully. But yeah, she's actually, you don't know whether she's getting pleasure from the, you know, the sex or talking about ratings. I mean, so she like goes really, she's off the deep end and she's television incarnate is what someone called her. And so I think that's where the shift happened is with this. I think it's the peak of the idealistic All the President's Men and the starting to foreshadow the dark side of, you know, predicting cable news like 20 years before it happens.
Yeah. Speaking of somebody who was cognizant of what was going on in the mid-70s, I can tell you that both those movies had a really big impact. All the President's Men had a huge impact on me personally. That was one of the movies that, you know, like a whole generation of journalists that inspired me to be a journalist. And yeah, I understand it's a little overblown in the way that, like, you know, the way that turned them into saints of journalism, that we're going to solve all the problems. But, you know, this is post Nixon, so there's a lot of this feeling that we needed to root out this evil or whatever these evils would be. But at the time, broadcast news, which I think at the time people recognized as a very important film, they didn't understand it as being prescient. They thought it was, oh, this is just a crazy farce. This will never happen. But now, if we have the perspective of time, everything in that movie is correct, and sadly. Mm-hmm. But the other thing that I think that movie, more so than All the President's Men, I think plays better to our times, because you forget, you mentioned the William Holden part, that the core of that, the emotional core of that movie is the fact that this was a generation of the people who had founded broadcast news, who were, you know, going out to the elephant's graveyard, and everything was being taken over by this younger, newer thing. And I think that speaks, I think, very much to what's going on in journalism right this moment. There are people who are bemoaning, or who want, wish for the days of old, but that's just not happening.
Yeah, and to me, I'm fascinated by, there's always been this interplay between film critics and filmmakers, almost like a symbiotic relationship. Uh-huh. Where, you know, back during the war years, a bunch of French critics didn't get to see all the American movies because of the Nazi occupation. And then once the war ended in 1945, all the French critics started going back and looking at the American movies, and they invented the term film noir, dark movies. So there's critics creating a whole genre. Flash forward a little bit later, the French critics, again, they're at it again. They do the Cahiers du Cinéma and become film. This is a magazine out there where they're reviewing art around like late 50s. And then in 59, you have Alain René, François Truffaut, Godard. They all move from being critics to actual filmmakers on the leading end of the art side of filmmaking, which then inspires all of our Hollywood renaissance of Scorsese, everyone in the slate. Yeah, like the whole Easy Riders to Raging Bulls thing. So there's critics, you know, both inventing genres in the way they're writing about it and also inventing or becoming filmmakers themselves and inspiring other filmmakers. So it's an interesting interplay, and I'd almost like to see a rebirth. This is idealistic of me. A rebirth of the critic filmmaker. That would be interesting.
I don't
Let's see what he says.
I don't think that's going to happen.
Probably
we're talking
not
about I think Ebert changed the entire thing because now you have Before him, the idea of a film critic was almost an art commentator.
Right,
you're not really giving your opinion on if someone's going to enjoy the movie, but the art of the film and what it represents and what's being done.
Sort of Pauline Kael.
Yes, exactly.
Yeah, exactly.
Who gave Dr. No a bad review because it wasn't like that's the famous example.
Got fired for panning Sound of Music.
Right, exactly. Yeah. Because these are
how can you pan?
The hills were alive.
So I think in the grand scheme of things, I don't think we're going to go back to that. You're still going to have critics who become filmmakers. That's going to happen, but I think the job of a critic now is far different from when critics were sort of turning into the art house filmmakers and the people who changed cinema. Now it's to tell people what movies they're going to like or not like, which some of that's good and some of that's bad. On the flip side of that, again, the web is revolutionizing everything. So you do have a lot of people out there publishing great content and, 90% of them aren't being read because they're just throwing it up on their WordPress or whatever. But someone out there is going to be writing, and then say, I'm going to make a movie, and they're going to be able to because it's so easy to make a movie now, and they're going to be the next great filmmaker. So,
wasn't it the joke or the dismissing critics is that they're all frustrated filmmakers, they're all frustrated creators.
That's me. I made a film in college and said, "No way, I'm going
to
critique."
I mean, you definitely hear that. And at the same time, it couldn't hurt to have to, even if you did it once and never wanted to do it again. It couldn't hurt to know how the process. Yeah,
it's not.
Right. So, you mentioned Ebert. I mean, with his passing a few months ago, I guess in a way it's this almost a line in the sand, end of an era. And now, I guess maybe, I mean, obviously the internet era existed in his later years too. But maybe we can finally close the chapter and that era is over. And now let's see what awaits now.
And we should give Roger Ebert credit.
For sure.
In
the digital age being pretty relevant. I mean.
Oh, and forward thinking.
Best transition from old school media to Twitter ever, I think. Like, he was great on Twitter.
And then he had his club. He was trying to monetize on the web as well. So.
And when I was talking about, the best list that started coming up, Ebert's web reviews, and he had a section where, regular reviews, but he has the Ebert great movies list. This is transitioning into the web, and so I think he deserves immense credit. And the day he died, the newspaper in Chicago, their website just totally went down, the Sun-Times. It crashed because so many people flocked there. So I think we may look back, actually, you raise a good point. We may look back and say he was that transitional figure. Siskel passed away with kind of still the TV era, maybe still with the thumbs up, thumbs down. But Ebert kind of made that transition.
Well, the two of them sort of created the role of the celebrity critic. And there are a lot of people who came in after, Roper as well, and there are others who were, magazine or TV critics and whatnot. But, certainly Ebert was the biggest of them.
I think they also, I read in some of his obits, he did transition from print to television to digital pretty seamlessly.
And he was a screenwriter. He did write Beyond the Valley of the Dolls.
Right. I used to love, his... here's something you should see that's on Netflix. I was like, this is great. This is a personal note from Roger Ebert. Watch this as I'm sitting there overwhelmed about what I should watch on Netflix.
What made him really work was that, I feel like I sounded like I was coming down harsh, but what made him really work...
We know you love Ebert. It's okay.
Was that he had that art house along with that pop culture together. And while I may think it has led film critics into a different role in culture, it's still an important role, and it might be even a better role because it has art house and pop culture combined instead of just the art house.
Since you brought up pop culture, I mean, is that really kind of where everything's sort of coming together? I mean, you also do game reviews and things like that. I mean, and I've been to Comic-Con a couple of times, which is graduated from being a comic book convention and a science fiction convention to just being everything
ever
and that there's this sort of homogenization of pop culture,
yeah,
so that it includes, if you're going to write about movies, you're going to have to write about games, you're going to have to do all the sort of stuff.
You might not have to write about them, but you need to understand them. Like, you can't be a film critic anymore without knowing comic book history.
Yeah.
I can't go into Superman without knowing the character of Superman. Mm-hmm. Thankfully, I grew up in an era and I read comic books, so I'm I'm on top of it. But, less so with video games, but becoming more so, you need to know the cultural impact of video games, mm-hmm. the stories they're telling, because video games are becoming one of the biggest storytelling genres out there. Before it was get to the end of the level, and now it's learn about your character.
Now, and I know, I hear this all the time, and people are very dismissive about what's going on in Hollywood right now, where you're going from one big blockbuster superhero movie to the next, giving people what they want to get. And, I think I mentioned the Scorsese thing, the documentary. There was some other documentary I saw where they talk about the movies of the 1970s and how influential they were. When studios would actually make good movies. They would make movies for different types of people. Oh, mm-hmm. this is only going to make, a couple of million dollars, but we're going to make it because we think it's an interesting story. And so because of that, you had an era where you had a lot of really important and really good movies. And now I don't know even if we're even in that space anymore.
You're trying to but what you're saying basically is that back then, even the mainstream movies had like crazy artistic things going on.
Right.
Could
you make
think about The Graduate? Was, we're going to appeal to all these kids. I mean, that was like Twilight then, but it's The Graduate. And it has,
there's
so many things going on in that movie, directing wise and writing, acting, or The Godfather.
Right.
That is one of the most, that and Part 1 and Part 2, are one of the most artistically done movies ever. But those were the huge blockbusters at the time.
Could you imagine how, if they made Godfather now as a blockbuster, how what it would be?
It would not be operatic. It would not have the 30-minute wedding opening. I mean, it's kind of sad if you think about it that way. In a way, we're getting more, shorter attention spans, I guess. But I do kind of miss, and don't get me wrong, I think great movies are still being made. Like we said, I think there's mm-hmm. the handful to a dozen, and there's still great filmmakers out there, like the Coens and, mm-hmm. Wes Andersons and P.T. Andersons and all those. Aronofsky, Fincher, there's mm-hmm. some good ones. Mm-hmm. But I do kind of long for the days where the mainstream movies were also important movies.
It's such a different release world, though. Back then, you released The Godfather, and it ran
for a year.
A year, right?
It was a theater.
No, I remember in the 1970s, we would go see. There would be a movie, and they would have a little thing in the box. 46 weeks in the same theater, mm-hmm. one screen theater. They would show one movie, and it would just be for the
right. You didn't have the glut of movies coming out every single week. And as long as the movie still made money, it was more like a theater run than movie run. Right. And so now,
like a Broadway show or something.
The opening weekend is such; it's the only deal. That's all. It's got to be big on the opening weekend.
That's why criticism is so important at this point, and word of mouth. That you want to know whether Man of Steel is coming out this weekend. I really want to see it because the commercials look really neat and everything. I wonder what the reviews say. And, some people are just going to go anyway.
Right.
But other people are still going to try to look to make that decision.
I'm someone who won't. It's too much money to go to a movie. If I will not go to a movie in a theater unless I've checked out multiple reviews. Right. And I'm sorry, forgive me. What is the movie, speaking of kind of dumb movies, I'm kind of interested in seeing? The Melissa McCarthy movie.
The Heat.
Mm. Yes. I'm confused about whether I should see it in the theater. I got invited. Right. But that, I'm using this as an example.
She needs to know whether she's going on state or not.
A discussion because The Heat's a really it looks like a dumb comedy, but because it has two female leads, it's a really complex.
Which is probably why I
go see it.
More
going on than you think. Audiences are roaring.
Yeah.
Do I want to support this movie because there are two women in it and buy a ticket? Or is it going to be really bad? So I think because it costs so much to go to the movies, people actually also seek out a lot of input before they go. Because otherwise, they're like, I can just wait a few months, and on my HBO, this movie will appear.
And to me, that kind of ties into that ray of hope I was talking about with people now being able to access anything, and the best lists in the internet age, and looking on IMDb, Rotten Tomatoes. I think everyone is more cognizant of let's pick and choose a little bit. So I think the idea of seeing a Rotten Tomatoes consensus percentage or Metacritic or IMDb, I think mostly it's a positive thing. I do also worry though about critics who maybe will see how something's maybe breaking nationally with the Rotten uh-huh. Tomatoes score, and they just kind of want to jump on the bandwagon. It's almost right. like do I really want to be the part of the 10% that like that movie? So I don't know how much speak to that. I mean, I don't know if do you think critics feel a pressure to go along with the tide, or do they ever want to break the mold?
I don't know
if you
notice this, but you can see it really easily on Rotten Tomatoes. So the way critics see movies is at film screenings beforehand, and we all see them together,
right.
basically. Right. Sometimes there are multiple ones, but usually with the same people each week. And so if you go on Rotten Tomatoes and you look at all the Washington, D.C. film critics, you'll notice it's not 100%, but you'll notice the opinions there are all around the
same. You see it in the same bubble.
And right, it's a bubble. And so, you know, because what we do when the movie's over is we talk about it. And because a film critic doesn't exist in a bubble either. You need to toss ideas around. Or any journalist doesn't exist mm-hmm. in a bubble. So I think you're right in that critics do get swayed by other critics if they're seeing all this stuff come up. But it's not an entirely bad thing, because you don't want to review solely on your initial reaction. You want to review on the world, what you think the world's reaction will be, because your job is to give an opinion to other people so that they will know if they want to see the movie or not. And so the majority of your reviews are your opinion, but being able to bounce ideas off other people or go online and say, oh, wow, everyone else panned this. Maybe I did miss something there. Is, I think, a good thing.
I remember, I did some reviews for a website, and I saw one of the movies I remember seeing was Scary Movie. And I was really kind of concerned about that movie because it's, on paper, it's not a particularly good movie. But you go into it with an audience, and it's an incredible mm-hmm. movie. It's because it becomes an experience. Mm-hmm. And so then your review is you have to kind of review about viewing it. That, okay, you know, if you're just watching this by yourself, maybe you're not going to have the same reaction. But you have to recommend it because, well, it's a very strange movie, but it's funny. And, you know,
the communal
experience of going to a movie. I mean, you kind of have to speak to that.
The perfect example of that is Snakes on a Plane. Which I saw at the midnight opening. I think we actually, some people, it was a group of connection people yeah, went to a midnight opening of it, and it was incredible.
I
it was like doing Rocky
go.
Horror Picture Show, basically.
Yeah, I think you have to factor that in, the movie-going experience.
Yeah,
you know?
And so my review was, whoa, this is so much fun, blah, blah, blah. And then I watched it again just by myself on TV, and I was like, this is horrible. What was I doing? Like,
raising another interesting point, though, is how individual experiences of where you watch it and who you watch it with, and you know how that affects. Also, you know, what were the five previous movies you just saw?
Right.
If they were all great, you're kind of itching to pan something, or vice versa. I mean, if you've seen a lot of bad stuff and then all of a sudden something that's actually pretty decent, you might even overrate it a little bit. It's funny how that works out.
Stub your toe on the way into the theater. You know, I try to like sit there and go, this isn't affecting me, but like your toe's throbbing the entire movie or something. This is just something I made up that's never actually happened to me. But
so you give this toes down.
Yeah. I remember, Kane.
Some of the more interesting reviews that I think Roger Ebert did were ones where he did a follow up review where he changed his opinion. Mm-hmm. Where he had a really, you know, visceral reaction to something, and then seeing it again or seeing a different edit. I think Brown Bunny was that the one that was the famous one where mm-hmm. he really, really trashed the director, and then the guy, well, no, that was an early draft, and then he rethought it. I don't think he loved the movie, but he thought it was a better movie. Have you ever had an experience where you've gone to see a movie again, and you're like, well, maybe it wasn't quite as bad or as quite as good as I thought it was the first time around. Maybe I would write that review differently.
Other than Snakes on a Plane.
Other than
Snakes on a
Plane.
I've stumped them.
Yeah.
Well, I mean, I know it happens a lot when you're going back and looking at the classics. I mean, I saw Scorsese speak at the Kennedy Center a couple of weeks ago, and He said, Vertigo is one of my, my all-time, that or Godfather favorites. And that's a movie that always puzzles people on first watch, I think. And
I've seen it a couple times, and I the last time I saw it, I came out with a kind of a negative feeling to it. So okay. I know that this is a big thing for you.
Hold
you
it
said,
up.
Go see it again. So I'm going to see it
yeah,
again.
Yeah, well, anyway. Yeah, but so what Scorsese was saying was that you haven't seen Vertigo until you've seen it again. And I only mentioned that in that I think you truly can't judge whether a movie's great or not until you've seen it a couple times. But you also have to factor in that gut reaction, and because the other part of your job is, you know, most people are only going to go see it once in the theater, and your job is trying to say, hey, do I go out on Friday and see this or not? So that has to be, like, first of mind when you're reviewing something. But I'm talking more a big picture, trying to determine whether a movie's great over, you know, looking back in hindsight. I think you really need to see something a couple times. In terms of a new movie, yeah, for me, the thorn in my side was I gave a rather mediocre 2.5 out of 4 stars for Avengers, and I went, and then I felt... yeah, look at his eyes. he said, crazy.
That
one kind of was bad radio.
No, that's a good example of something where I went, and what you said, there was all these technical glitches in the theater. The eye went out. On
the
one
screening
of,
was awful.
Oh yeah, it was, and it kept it was like it was almost like a DVD skipping yeah. when you're watching it, and then one of your eyes of your 3D glasses went out entirely. I was like, is that a Nick Fury eye patch? Like, so. I don't know. I walked out, and you know, there was a lot I loved. There were so many cool pop culture references that Joss Whedon was doing. But maybe it was just that experience, or it was a late night or something. But then you go back and watch it again after the huge phenomenon, and you're like, oh, that was better when I watched it again on DVD. And then lo and behold, I loved Iron Man 3 this year. I thought it was great. I thought it was way better than Superman. Yeah. So that's an example of, you know, we're not always right. We're not always right. Or and what is right?
I'm always right. My opinion is 100% correct.
My own experience with the Washington Post critics, when they had a whole staff of critics, so there was one particular critic, I won't name this person, but whatever that critic said, I would, if they said don't go see this movie, I would go see the movie, because I trusted their taste enough that it was... I kind of had a sense of where they were shooting from, that if it was a movie that person didn't like, then it would be something I probably would like.
Right.
And that worked out. So again, it's important to, you know your sources to identify anything. Well, let's sort of wrap this up. What's your thoughts right now about criticism moving forward? Do you think we're in a good place? Is it going to change? Is, you know, are you sort of optimistic about, you know, this type of journalism sort of continuing to get better, or is it going to stagnate? You know, what's your thought?
Well, we've kind of talked about it a little already. I'm more, I try to be hopeful. It's so easy to be cynical about it. When you see the old channels and avenues you used to have to go down to become a critic, you know, go to film school and all, you know, work your way up at a paper. When those walls got totally shattered by the internet, it's easy to be cynical about it. But I like to remain hopeful for some of the reasons I've said about, you know, there's this whole way of a whole new generation coming up where they're sifting through which movies do I have to go back and rediscover by the IMDb top 250 right. or whatever, you know,
it's
whatever.
The same problems they still had to deal with.
Yeah.
But now...
Yeah, it's. I think it's an exciting time, and we'll still see how it shifts. You know, whether, you know, I think most, like 70% of movie gross comes from home video, whether it's, you know, on demand or DVD sales or whatever, Netflix. But I mean, I think we're going to start shifting to that. I mean, there'll always be a place for going to a theater and seeing in a dark room without distractions. You're not folding your laundry while you're watching it. You know, on a tiny screen on your bed, on your iPad. But well, that's an extreme example of why I think, you know, going to a theater will still matter. But I think it'll be less and less. I mean, you were saying you pick and choose whether you actually want to go spend the money. I think there'll always be a place for the movies, but I think how it's distributed is definitely, we're already seeing a change right before our eyes. People binge watch, you know, House of Cards or Mad Men over a weekend, and actually a lot of TVs, you know, getting better than movies in that episodic long binge watch format. Mad Men or The Wire or, you know, Sopranos. So.
Yeah. What's your thought?
In terms of journalism, I think, you know, we say anyone can be a film critic, anyone can get online, and, you know, it's kind of a cynical view, but what what happens is the good stuff still rises to the top. Yes, there's sensationalism and bad reporting, but what you'll see is that great writers are at the great sites putting out great stuff. So it is a world where it's much easier for someone to become a film critic, but still, but I think the good film criticism gets out there and gets people reading.
Okay. Yeah. How can people find out about you guys, or where can they get your information? Oh, you have a question.
Yeah. Can you guys, like, real quick, maybe give one or two places that you go for film criticism, either people or podcasts or websites? Not Flixis.
No. Flixis is the only.
Well,
right. Yeah. Or WTOP.
I mean, I check out Metacritic a lot because it's kind of it's more of a global consensus than just, Rotten Tomatoes too. Those
that's
are two places.
How that's grown.
What, Rotten Tomatoes? Yeah.
Yeah.
But what you're saying too is, I think the major publications on there, like they still get more weight. I think.
Oh yeah.
You see
yeah.
the Washington Post, and Hornaday gave this, or you know, Time, or Rolling Stone.
And
yeah.
You can shift
it. Yeah. I actually like checking out. This is because I have to produce radio pieces for the radio, and it's more of a music and trailer cuts and everything. I like checking out Richard Roper's. He has like a YouTube video review every time. So I like seeing things like that too, where it's not. You're not just reading a print thing, because I think it can be helpful to see how the story can be told broadcast wise for a video, and audio is kind of the same deal. But yeah, any ones you go check out?
It's gonna sound a little cliche, but there's a reason A.O. Scott writes for the New York Times, because he is absolutely fantastic, just brilliant. And then the Onion's AV Club is.
AV Club's
awesome.
Great. Yeah.
Yeah, I go there for television reviews a lot.
Yeah.
They have some good best lists, too.
I'm going to throw in Film Spotting to the podcast that is done on WBUZ. It's really great. It's not always on topic, so it's not like movie of the week. Sometimes they're like, let's just talk about Hitchcock films. So, you know.
That can be useful.
No, that is useful, but like I don't know if I need to talk about Westerns made in a certain decade. I that's not useful to me necessarily, but it's a great place to
give him a chance. The Westerns are awesome.
Preston Sturgis weekend.
Talk to my father.
Yeah, I actually kind of hope more critics will, you know, if they have a show, maybe. Highlight something new that came out, and then something that they can, like you said, here's what you should watch on Netflix, even if it's something old or new or whatever. Kind of fold in the here's what you can go in the old way of going to the movies with, you know, here's the new release. But then for all of you else, you know, who seek these other avenues, check this out, which ties into your Hitchcock thing.
Which is the thing that Netflix does. You watched this, you gave this a good review. You know, maybe you'll like this movie. And so that's sort of a way to do that. So how can people reach you, follow your work, you know, learn more about the reviews you're doing?
We have under our living section on WTOP.com, there's a section called Fraley on Film that has a running list of all the web reviews. And you can hear my audio reviews Friday mornings at 40 past the hour, but it's only on the odd hours, 5:40, 7:40, 9:40, 11:40.
Do those go online? The audio?
Yeah, I always embed the on-air audio within the web piece. I like to write up a longer web piece, too. I mean, that's like the old school film critic. I mean, you have more. You can only do so much in a minute of on-air. I mean, so you really expand it out. Twitter, nickname around the newsroom is Jay Fray, Jason Fraley. So it's Above the Jay Fray is the Twitter handle, at Above the Jay Fray. And the filmspectrum.com, the blog, still going.
How about you, Matt?
You can find my writing on Flixist.com. It's Flixist. And we do hourly news, you know, mostly with a humorous slant, and then reviews every week and in-depth features, things like that for reading. I'm on Twitter. It's Matthew_Razak, which now sounds really uncreative.
But you're easier to find. What is above the...
and then I also do reviews for examiner.com every so often.
Okay. Great. All right, great. Well, thanks for coming in. This has been great.
Yeah, a lot of fun. Thanks for having us.
Yeah.
You've been listening to It's All Journalism, a weekly podcast about the changing state of media.
You can subscribe to this podcast on iTunes or find out more information about It's All Journalism at itsalljournalism.com.
We'd like to hear what you have to say. If you have topics that you'd like us to cover or suggestions about who to interview, email us at editor@itsalljournalism.com.
Off the look for It's All Journalism on Facebook and follow us on Twitter at All Journalism.